Welcome to this installment of Witness to Yesterday, the podcast of the Champlain Society. My name is Greg Marshaldon, and today I'm going to talk to James Urry about Mennonites. Born in London, England, James is an anthropologist and historian connected to Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand. In the past, he's written extensively on the history of Mennonites in Russia and in Canada. But today, we're going to talk to him about his very fine-grained study of a Mennonite community in Manitoba. The time period that he covers is between the 1920s and the 1970s. His book is entitled On Stony Ground, Ruslander Mennonites and the Rebuilding of Community in Grunthal, and is about to be released by the University of Toronto Press. James, welcome to Witness to Yesterday. So, can you tell us a little bit about your own background and how it relates to your long-standing interest in Mennonite history?
Well, I did my degree in the University of London, and then I went to Oxford. And like most anthropologists, you have to have a people to study. And I decided that I might like to go and study Mennonites in Belize, in Central America. But before that, I had to complete a degree, sort of looked at the background to these people. I knew that they'd come from Russia, and I knew there were different migrations. So I decided to go to Canada and speak with some of the people, including the people who I knew had come out of Russia in the 1920s. I was fairly ignorant about what I was about to encounter. I went to Manitoba because I met a Mennonite in Oxford, and he invited me to the Canadian Mennonite Bible College in Winnipeg. And so I set out to do what anthropologists often do, not anthropology, but ethnography, to start talking to real Mennonites. It was a bit of a surprise because the Mennonites who'd come out from 1920s, a number of whom were still alive, were nothing like I thought the Mennonites in Belize were. The Mennonites who came out in the 1920s had come out after the Russian Revolution and Civil War. And I suddenly discovered that they were not sort of Mennonites in plain clothing riding around in buggies, but in Russia they'd been immensely wealthy, owning lots of land, private estates, factories, mills, and various other things. And so I began to think about how this had come about. And that was the subject of my thesis about how the Mennonites had been transformed in Russia in the 100 years they settled. They came in the end of the 18th century. And so I was looking for the period about 1890, although these people came out in the 1920s.
So for our general audience, just tell us, who are the Mennonites? Why do they tend to separate themselves from the general population when they settle in areas? And why did they leave places like Russia?
Well, the background to the Mennonites is from the Reformation. Luther really wanted to reform the Catholic Church, but ended up splitting the Church into Protestants and Catholics. A Mennonite, Walter Klaassen, wrote a very good book with the title of Neither Catholic Nor Protestant. And so the Mennonites come from a group who really rejected both and thought they were founding a new society. It was a very chaotic time, the Reformation, and these people believed that the end of the world was about to come, and so they had to form small communities in the hope of salvation. The chaos which resulted eventually settled down into communities which went on reproducing themselves, and the idea of the end of the world drifted away, although they still thought that they were forming communities. there's a Mennonite joke about Mennonites in heaven, and when they first got there, they were sort of sitting behind a wall, and people warned that they should be quiet because Mennonites thought they were the only people there.
Well, as you mentioned, I mean, you had early contact with the Mennonites in Manitoba. And so what I'm interested in is your focus in this book on one community, Grunthal, and the reason why you chose this community in particular to really examine.
Well, I knew that this particular community had been founded by groups that came from Russia in the 1870s, the first big migration from Russia. But I knew that these people, the majority had gone to Paraguay in the 1920s, and the place was inhabited by Mennonites who came in the 1920s from the Soviet Union. The group who came in the 1870s are sometimes referred to as Canadia, Canadian Mennonites, and the group who came in the 1920s are sometimes called Ruslander, although these terms are fairly archaic now in the Mennonite world. And I thought it would be useful to actually look at how the Mennonites who came in the 1920s interacted with the Mennonites who didn't go to Paraguay. It turned out, after meeting them, that it turned out, and the book deals with this, that was only one dimension. Another dimension is about how different Ruslander got on with each other and started to build a community, and also how they got on with their neighbours around, which were a very diverse set of immigrants to Canada.
You've hinted this at this already, but you know, between 1923 and 1926, as you point out in your book, 20,000 Mennonites came to Canada from the Soviet Union. How did they live in Russia compared to how they lived in Canada? It seemed quite a striking contrast between their former lives in the Soviet Union and their new lives in Canada.
Well, you have to realize that the Soviet Union was newly formed, and the period of the revolution and the chaos of the Civil War had destroyed large areas of the Mennonite life. A lot of the first immigrants were, in fact, refugees within the Soviet Union. They had been the people who lived on private land, big estates, owned factories and mills and various other things. The factories and mills were nationalized by the Soviet state, and the Mennonites on private land, their land had been seized by peasants, so they'd fled to the longer settled Mennonite colonies where they were cluttering up the world, as it were. So lots of people were interested in getting them out. They couldn't go home. They had to go to Canada.
Tell us the difference between the Ruslander Mennonites and the Canadia Mennonites.
Well, one of the things is the years. The Canadia started to come in the 1870s, and they had a much more conservative view of the world. And especially in the Grunthal area, they were more closely knitted through kinship and church affiliation. The Ruslander were much more scattered. They'd come to Canada hoping to rebuild their worlds, but they found they didn't have the capital to do it. And so they were living in all sorts of rented and land all over the place, right across Canada from Ontario, right into Saskatchewan and eventually into Alberta and British Columbia. They couldn't rebuild their lives. They had a higher level of education. They were ambitious, whereas the Canadia were reasonably conservative, closely bound to the land, not interested in making a lot of money. And the Ruslander were, as it were, sort of driven to rebuild their lives in Canada, but they also had a much bigger base of education and ambition, as it were, although without the resources to do it.
Now, you're both a historian and an anthropologist, and you use both documentary and oral evidence in this book. So I think you're the perfect person to ask about the nature of the relationship between these two types of evidence. I'd like you to talk about that as well as tell us what was the most useful documentary evidence as well as other sources that you use to reconstruct the history of the Grüntal Mennonites?
Well, documents consist of all types of sometimes they're letters and memoirs, sometimes they're official reports, sometimes they're tax returns and all sorts of things. What's missing is aspects of life where people talk about it, what they felt like, the arguments they had. You could say that oral stuff doesn't have the sort of official line, like people don't remember how much tax they paid, how much land they owned and various things. So bringing the things together, as it were, one provides a base, and history provides a base which is often missing from memory. People's memories are not marvellously good. But the documents don't have the feel of life. They don't have, you know, the petty squabbles, the opinions of various things. Grüntal, I said, was full of Ruslander, and the most interesting thing about it was how Ruslander from different backgrounds in Russia didn't get on with each other. They came from very different worlds. The core group in Ruslander were owners of large amounts of private land. They had wealthy, they had pretensions, social sort of looking down your nose at people and various things like that. They came from a place called Schönfeld, the sort of beautiful field, and their forefathers had bought this land and they had peasants to work for it. In the Revolution and Civil War, the peasants came back claiming the land as their own and booted the Mennonites off. So you also had people who came from the colonies who blamed these people for causing all the problems in Russia. So they also had different views of history. None of that you will find in documents particularly. Mennonites write their own history and they often take out all the conflicts, all the nasty bits. They tend to write romantic things. When you go in and talk to them, you sort of get the stories of how people didn't get on. If you look at a tax return or a land ownership, you don't get the answer of why people owned this bit of land or that bit of land. You had to end up asking them to find out that type of thing.
One of the things that I picked up in the book was the importance of the Mennonite Board of Colonization. Can you tell us a little bit about the board and how its functions morphed over time?
Well, interestingly, the board was founded as one of the aid agencies that went into Russia, and it helped organize a lot of the migration. In the 1870s, Mennonites were not only going to Canada, but also to the United States. In fact, the more progressive ones went to the United States, but a lot of Mennonites continued to come after 1870s, and they often went to further west to Saskatchewan, and they were better educated. So it was in Rosthern in Saskatchewan that the Board of Colonization was founded. The United States wouldn't accept Mennonites, but Canada would. And so they negotiated, especially with the railway company, the Canadian Pacific Railway, to help move these penniless refugees from the Soviet Union, from Europe to Canada. The CPR lent them money, as it were. This was known as the Reiseschuld, the debt, the travel debt. And so Mennonites had to repay this money. So the Board of Colonization actually arranged this. Their records still exist. Every Mennonite has a record. There's the financial things of how much they paid back. Some of them never paid it back, actually. And because it was a debt they carried often for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years until it was cleared after the Second World War. The Board of Colonization also had subgroups with ambitions to actually recreate the Russian world in Canada. This eventually was sort of abandoned in the 1930s because it was obvious that trying to organize collecting the money and various things was much more important than trying to chase fantasies of hoping to build a Russia on the Canadian prairies or in Ontario. Some of these Mennonites settled in Ontario, actually.
You've already mentioned the very high levels of debt that accumulated in terms of the travel expenses as well as associated medical expenses. And this debt was quite large when the Great Depression hit. How did these Ruslanders survive the economic and agricultural crisis of the 1930s? And for those who ended up working outside their communities during this period, like the young women you mentioned that worked as maids in Winnipeg, how did they keep up their Mennonite ties?
Well, the pursuit of money became a major factor in Mennonite lives. And you've got to realize that they continued to marry, continued to have children, so the debts accumulated. I mentioned Schoenfelders and various other things. They used cheap peasant labor. There are hilarious tales from Grunthal where these once large landowners had to start farming. And, you know, Canadian equipment and horses who didn't understand Ukrainian tended to be rather difficult to handle. Some of them weren't particularly farmers. They were sort of romantic readers of books and various things. So the problem of pursuit of money became a major thing. And the whole family had to raise money. And one of the things in Manitoba is you could send your daughters to be maids in Winnipeg. Some Mennonites did settle in Winnipeg, by the way. They had this sort of urban push away from farming. The Mennonite girls who went to work in Winnipeg actually enjoyed it. I mean, they started to learn English better. They could buy clothes and various things like that. But they were under strict control. And so, you know, the Mennonites in Winnipeg kept a, you know, close eye on the girls. In terms of various things that happened later, they went to work for British descendants who were much wealthier, of course. These were known collectively to Mennonites as Englander, the English. And the English were sort of strange in the Mennonite mind. They were people to be feared at a certain level because you could be ver-Englished, which meant you lost your Mennonite faith and you became like the English. The ironic thing, of course, is the descendants of a lot of these Ruslander have been thoroughly ver-Englished in a way. But they were also admired. They were like what the Ruslander wanted to be like, but not be English. And so it was a bit of a puzzle. There is a slight twist to this. Some of the girls went to work for wealthy Jewish groups, and this would later become a bit of a problem in the Mennonite mind.
So what was the relationship then between the Ruslanders and their neighbours? And in that area, the Grunthal area, it was mainly French, Canadian, Ukrainian, and Indigenous populations. So what was the nature of their interaction?
They tended to look down their noses at Canada, but they all shared a common language. Although the Ruslander favoured High German through education and church, everybody spoke Plattdeutsch, which is a sort of Low German, and so they got on fairly well. But their neighbours didn't speak this. What you had was Ukrainians. They tended to be not Ukrainians from southern Ukraine, which is where Mennonites, a large number of them, came from, but from further north, from the sort of western area. They got on fairly well with them because they could interact. And some of those Ukrainians actually founded businesses in Grunthal, and they got on extremely well. Some of them learned Low German, for instance, but they weren't allowed to look at the girls. The French Canadians were somewhat different because they were Catholic. You still had this run of Catholicism. There was interaction, but not strong. With the Indigenous people, they were very rare. They came from reserves further to the south. There were no roads. Now and then they'd turn up, sometimes begging, sometimes willing to work, but after 3 days disappeared. And so there was a lot less interaction with them. Most Ruslander interaction was with Canada, with Ukrainians, sometimes with French Canadians, and sometimes with Englander, who were often officials or people in power.
So how was primary and secondary education delivered in communities such as Grunthal in terms of the language of instruction, the teachers, educational attainment?
This was a major difference between Kanadia and Ruslanda. The education was controlled by the Manitoban government, and one of the things which had caused the emigration of Mennonites to Middle and South America during the First World War was them taking over the Mennonite schools, and they were to be English schools because they were to bring these people into the Canadian way of life. The Ruslander didn't have any problems with that. In schooling in Russia, it had moved into Russian with only German taught as another subject. And so the idea that you had schools which predominantly were taught in English with German as a side thing didn't upset them too much. After all, they wanted to get into the larger Canadian society, and the major route was through education. But they wanted the teachers to be Mennonite, at best Ruslander. So a whole set of newly arrived school teachers hurriedly went through the school training system. And in Grunthal, they got a very professional Prussian-type school teacher, Mr. Heiderbrecht, who stayed there for some time and was very strict. They liked strict schooling, and everything was done in English. One of the professors, Mennonite professors at the University of Winnipeg, whose father actually taught in Grunthal, who was a Canadian, said they could always spot a Grunthaler because they had a very strange accent in English. And they put this down to this school teacher, who, of course, English was a second language for him. So the Ruslander really pushed education, pushed English, and it created in some ways a generation gap. Education was a key in this differentiation. And later it would become a problem because although they wanted to build a community, their children, in fact, left the community. So in a sense, the higher education, and they really pushed higher education, was to defeat their attempts to build a community because these people, when they were more successful, left the community and went into the world. One of their really important sons was the professor of German, as he would become in the University of Winnipeg, an eclectic man called Jack Thiessen, who would eventually write a dictionary of Low German published by a major press.
How did the Ruslander interact with local, the provincial Manitoba government, and the federal government?
Well, there were various levels of government. Of course, you had local government, which was based on the sort of regional subdivisions. And in this, there were Mennonites and non-Mennonites. And of course, they were used to having self-government, a degree of self-government in Russia. So one of the things was that their leaders began to push into this system, get a system. The interesting thing is that both the Manitoban Member of Parliament or Member of the Assembly and the Member in Parliament in Ottawa were established families of French Canadians. Mennonites tended to vote for them because they voted for the Liberal government on the grounds that it was a Liberal government which had permitted them to come to Canada. So it was a fairly primitive understanding of democracy. And if you think about Russia, they didn't have a background very much in understanding democracy. There was a czar, and degrees of self-government were quite strong, but sort of voting for things only occurred after 1905 and then a little bit dodgy. So they were fairly ignorant of democratic processes.
I was surprised at the pro-Nazi sentiments expressed by some community members during the 1930s and the early 1940s. So the question I have for you is, did this really involve a tiny minority or was it a bit larger than that? And what was the relationship between Canadian authorities and Mennonite communities like Grunthal after Canada entered the war?
If you imagine that Mennonites came to Canada with one world destroyed, the old world of the Russian in the revolution and stuff, and they were still in contact with friends and kin in Canada. But you've got to realise, in Russia, I mean in the Soviet Union turned quite vicious, eventually leading to the Great Terror. And then in the 1930s, you get this rise of Nazi Germany. Mennonites were ambiguous about whether they wanted to be for English or wanted to maintain German, because German was the language of religion and it became a language of more than religion, you know, of culture and various things. The Depression seemed to destroy their hopes of recreating the other world. And so they turned more to the creation of this new world that was creating in Germany, and some of them quite admired it. You've got to realise that the German government was also pumping literature into any part of the world which they saw overseas Germans. So, you know, the consul in Winnipeg was busy pumping out literature. The Mennonites had a shortage of books. In Grunthal, they had a lending library with lots of books, which with the outbreak of war, they either burnt or destroyed or buried. I get two stories. You had a lot of books. I mean, the numbers on it go up to 300. And they wanted something to read. I mean, this is a fairly lonely place in Manitoba. And a lot of this new literature was full of Nazi various things. You've got to remember also that the Prime Minister of Canada, Mackenzie King, was sort of, he admired Hitler and went to the Nuremberg rally. I'm not sure Canadians know that too much. They tend to have blank areas in their history too. And so there was a lot of pro-German views as well as sort of British views across Canada. When the war broke out, you've got to realise too that Hitler made an alliance with Stalin. This was something the Mennonites could not even understand. I mean, Stalin was an antichrist. So for a short period, there was a sort of terrible thing. But then Hitler invaded the Soviet Union. And I have stories of the bachelors. Mennonite bachelors are a strange group, because if they never married, they didn't really be full members of the community, and they could get away with doing all sorts of things that a married man couldn't, or a married woman. And they had a feast celebrating the invasion of the Soviet Union with Mennonite caviar, which happened to be cans of sardines. Some Mennonites sort of joined the army, because the Canadian army wasn't actually, although they're meant to be non-resistance Mennonites, sometimes thought to be pacifists, so pacifist is the wrong term. All they did was transport German prisoners across Canada. But then Canada changed the rules and they were to serve abroad. And two of these then left the army on their own terms. And the Royal Canadian Mennonite Police used to turn up to look for them. Of course, they were hidden.
Well, in other Mennonite communities, I've heard reference to CO camps, conscientious objector camps, and the kind of enforced family separation between males and women and children back home. It didn't sound like this was a prominent feature in Grunthal in the same way.
Well, I think it is a matter of what age. Who was conscripted was based on age, and there weren't very many in that age group. The conscientious objector camps weren't really like prison camps at all. You know, you went and cut trees and various things. Mennonites got away quite easily with this type of thing. There weren't very many from the Ruslander community who were taken into this type of service. There were more Canadia. I don't think it was a big issue. It certainly did sort of split families up, but there were also ways of alleviating. After all, they were still in Canada. They weren't serving abroad and likely to get killed, were they?
Mm-hmm. So war, and then the initial years of after the war of economic growth brought about great prosperity. What was the impact of this prosperity on the Grunthal Mennonite?
Well, I think there are three things to realise about this. One is the economic situation improved before the Second World War, in fact. You know, we talk about the dirty 30s and stuff, but from about 1935 onwards, the bad years were fading away and the economy was lifting. So they went into the war reasonably well. In the war, there were lots of opportunities, and the war was actually an economic time of sort of boom. Unlike the First World War, it didn't all collapse at the end of the war. They'd learned the lesson at the end of the First World War, and so it continued to improve. Mennonites sort of forgot about allegiances and, you know, began to think that things were getting better. And so, you know, it was the dream which they had at the end of the 1920s, destroyed by the onset of the Depression, seemed to be able to lift them, and they could forget about old allegiances.
So how did the Ruslander eventually become Canadian in terms of social and cultural allegiances?
One Mennonite who I spoke with came up with a very interesting phrase. He said to me, he'd been born in Russia but came as a small child. He said to me, "This is my country. It was never my father's." And so that whole generation of Ruslander lived in exile. That's how it was. And although things were better and they steadily joined, you know, various Canadian things, there was no going back. You've got to remember that some thought the Soviets would collapse and they'd go home. It was clear that that was never going to happen. The Cold War at least made them proud that Americans and Canadians understood what terrible people the Soviets were. But in a sense, even it all depended on the person. The shopkeeper, the major private shopkeeper, for instance, who certainly owned a copy of Mein Kampf with pencil marks, his son gave it to me, suddenly became terribly keen on ice hockey. He had a whole set of sons. Ice hockey is a good way into Canadian culture. And so, you know, the better conditions made them at least take up sort of Canadian things. But remember the words of that son, "It was never my father's land." So in some ways, that generation had to pass. And you've got to remember that these children of the Ruslander were educated in Canadian schools. Schooling is a great thing for creating nationalism, and certainly this was the good way of doing it. In my book, I discuss some very strange things that occur, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, and that is, you know, Canadians used to have fairs, and they eat Canadian food. They have a Mennonite beauty queen sitting on a tractor. She's the daughter of a Ruslander, and there's a big Canadian, you know, the new Canadian flag behind her, a great symbolism of nationalism. I still believe that that first generation of Ruslander, which is really what my book's about, came to terms with living in Canada, but they never really perhaps came to terms with living in exile. That had to be left to their children. I'd just like to say that although my book's about this town of Grunthal, right, in southern Manitoba, it's also a book about all Ruslander. And, you know, 21,000 is a big immigration, probably one of the biggest immigration that occurred between 1923 and roughly 1926-27, up to that time in Canadian history. And there's an awful lot of descendants, some of whom may no longer be Mennonite by faith, but I can spot their names quite clearly in the records of businesses, medical centres, universities, and various other things.
James, I want to thank you so much for joining us today from New Zealand.
Thank you. It's been fun.
My My guest today was James Urey. His book, On Stony Ground, Ruslander Mennonites and the Rebuilding of Community in Grunthal, is published by the University of Toronto Press. You've been listening to Witness to Yesterday. Please visit our website at www.champlainsociety.ca. The best way you can support this website is by becoming a subscribing member of the Champlain Society. This podcast is made possible by the members of the Champlain Society who work hard to bring to life original documents in Canadian history. We want to thank the L.R. Wilson Institute of History at McMaster University, as well as a consortium of Canadian scholarly book publishers that includes the University of Toronto Press, UBC Press, McGill Queen's University Press, the University of Regina Press, and the University of Ottawa Press. My name is Greg Marshaldon. This interview was recorded on February 13th, 2024. This podcast is supported by our producer, Jessica Schmidt, and the University of Toronto Press journal team.